G'day there, Jeff.
Good day to you.
Did you think when you were sitting in Abbey Road Studios all those years ago that over 40 years later you'd still be relaying the stories?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, we knew what was happening at the time, and we knew it was special, but never gave it a thought that this would happen.
Yeah. You started off at such an early age, didn't you? What was
Yeah.
it that drew you towards recording studios at what, the age of 15?
Well, just of the music, really. I fell in love with music from the age of 7 onwards when I found my grandmother's records and stuff, and I had a toy gramophone and used to play them. And then through the years, I just fell in love with music more than the technical side, you know. And I wanted to be involved in creating records, to be honest with you. That's what it was all about.
So how did you get the job at EMI? I take it there would have been a lot of young chaps like yourself hoping to get their foot inside the door.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a letter to them for an interview. It was only like 4 studios or 5 studios in those days, and got rejection letters. And then I kept insisting to my careers officer that that's where I really wanted to work. And he was trying to tell me, "Oh, do you want to work here, work there?" And I just kept insisting, "I want to work in a recording studio." And by chance, it was EMI Studios then, and not Abbey Road. They contacted the careers officer of a local studio school in St John's Wood. For like an apprentice type guy, and they had no one who really wanted to do that job. And then he was friendly with my careers officer, and he passed the message to my careers officer, and that's how the interview came about.
I guess you must have spent at least a few minutes over your life thinking about what might have been if those two hadn't have had a good relationship.
Yeah, I know. It's looking back on it, it's an intriguing story, really, I guess.
Yeah. So, what was your, I guess your first memory of the Fab Four coming through the door? It was the very early stages of their career, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, sure. Because I was learning the ropes for the first 2 weeks, and it was the second day I was there. They came in for the recording of "Love Me Do," and I was privy to be in the control room because I asked the guy, "Could I just to learn a bit faster? Could I just be in the control room just to see what was going on?" And of course, in those days, they were just another band, you know.
Yeah, you had no idea when they started singing together and playing together that this was going to be one of the most famous groups in history.
No, except there was a buzz going around the studio, and I think it was just everything was very sort of strict and stuff. And I think these guys had come in there, and they were a bit more fun to work with. And I think the buzz had gone around the studios, "Oh, you want to see this band from Liverpool, you know?" Because they come down for their artist test, and then I think they came in. That the artist test was in June, and they came in to record "Love Me Do." Yeah.
Yeah. At that point in time for you, what were you interested in from a recording side of things? I mean, here you were at a time and place, not only was the band to be extraordinarily famous, but the techniques that they would to eventually use in their recordings would become quite famous, and you were an integral part of that. From the early stages, what were you interested in?
Well, I mean, from the early stages, I mean, I was, I, you know, I had my favourite records and sounds and stuff. I can't, at that time, before I joined EMI, sort of, thought about sounds, because I wasn't privy to hearing a lot of American stuff. But during the course of being at Abbey Road, I was cut mastering playback lacquers and stuff, and doing some of the American records. So, it was the intrigue of things like "River Deep Mountain High." You think, wow, that's a great sound. And there was a certain sound that was at Abbey Road, that was the Abbey Road or EMI sound at that time. And then I just thought, well, it can be a bit better, I guess. And because when we were put under pressure, especially when we started, when we started to do Revolver, they wanted sounds that never, they were just getting fed up with the old sort of normal sound of the, the pop sound from EMI. But the only way I could achieve that was to just abuse the equipment, really.
Which I'm glad to say had a wonderful outcome. Take us through some of those. I'm sure you've spoken about them many times, but some of those little tricks that you employed to get those sounds that have become such a part of music history, really.
Well, when we first sort of discovered the sounds, if you want to call them that, I mean, the biggest one ever was to put stuff through a Leslie speaker, and the first thing that ever went through that was Lennon's vocal, for "Tomorrow Never Knows." And then, the drum sound needed more punch, and I started to lower the mics and get closer in with the mics, and got told off for that, and because I was going to damage the mics. And then, the only big pieces of outboard gear we really had were Fairchild limiters. and some Altec compressors, and that was the normal in every control room.
So you're talking about, by today's standards, this is incredibly basic equipment that we're talking about here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, no one had ever put the drums through the Fairchild and the way I'd done it, and it was a completely new sound, you know.
Mm. We're speaking with Jeff Emmerich tonight. He was an engineer on a number of those incredibly famous Beatles albums. He's gone on to have a rich and a wonderful career producing all sorts of famous people over the years, and he's going to be in the country at the end of this month at a trade show, and a nice chance to have a chat to him tonight here on the radio. I take it EMI was pretty tight with their money too, that they were pretty stern with their rules. Even though you had a band like the Beatles, they didn't really like spending money, did they?
Oh, well, no, not really. I mean, you were supposed to record 3 songs in 3 hours, you know. There was like a morning session, an afternoon session, an evening session, and a full session ran for 3 hours. I believe their very first album was done in a day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But the other thing was, it was we were looked down upon, because at that time, you know, it was the focus was on the classical music that was coming out of there, and we were looked down upon, you know, all the pop side. But it was the pop side that was making the money to pay for the classical records, you know.
What's your on Revolver? What's the song that you feel most proud of?
Oh, Tomorrow Never Knows, I guess, because that was the beginning of everything. You know, what could be done and what couldn't be done, and, you know, how far can we push the boundaries, you know?
George Martin, I take it, was a fairly big part of that process, and the teamwork that you and he the group had together. What sort of discussion would be going on for making the decisions?
Well, just what can we do? I mean, George was the one that spent most time out in the studio with them, working out the arrangements or whatever, and then we had the luxury of time to be able to, work out new sounds and stuff. And, you know, and the, one of the best things we ever came up with was automatic double tracking. You know, and Richard Lush, who was the assistant on many Beatles albums, especially Pepper, was the master at controlling the automatic double tracking machine. So we used to have good fun doing that, you know.
Mm. Speaking of Sergeant Pepper's, we're talking about an era when the band themselves were pushing themselves so much as well. What was the mood like in the studio for it?
It was good. It was hard work, but it was good. It was sort of mellow, and there was not real arguments at all. Not like what developed into the White Album.
Mm.
Well, as you know, because what happened when we'd done the Revolver album, they tried to perform some of those things or tracks live on stage, because they were still on tour after that. And they couldn't pull it off. So when we started the Pepper album, you know, the first time we were in the control room and John came in, they all came in, and John sort of said to George, he said, well, you know, we're going to make an album that's going to have sounds on that we haven't got to worry about, you know, to be able to perform those sounds live. And so everyone looked at me, of course, and then I haven't got anything to use to make these incredible sort of things, but of course we did. But so that was the approach. So they were never going to go on tour again, and we could come up with an array of all sorts of stuff, you know.
Mm. Well, the work on Sergeant Pepper's earned you a Grammy Award. You would have been a very young man to have received such a large award.
Yeah, I guess, about, what was that, 21, something like that.
Yeah, about 21. did you pinch yourself? Did you wake up in the morning? I mean, especially when you're walking up on stage to receive a Grammy Award, realising just how quickly, what was 6 years?
I didn't actually walk up on stage to receive it. The only one I've ever walked up on stage was the band on the run. The first I knew of it was when it appeared in the manager's office at Abbey Road.
Oh, really?
And he thought that he should keep it.
Did you finally get it, Jeff? Did you?
Oh, yeah. No, Ringo actually presented it down in studio number 3. but they really thought that Abbey Road should keep it. It was theirs.
Mm. Jeff Emmerich is with us tonight. As you can hear, he was somebody closely involved in the creative process for the Beatles. He's gone on to have a rich and illustrious career in music and sound, but of course he will always be remembered for engineering these extraordinary albums, Revolver, Sergeant Pepper's, Abbey Road. Getting to the White Album, though, you literally walked off. I don't know if it was in a huff, but you certainly walked out of there, didn't you?
Oh yeah, we'd recorded about 10 or 11 tracks, and it was getting really uneasy in the studio. They'd started to turn the volume of the guitar amps up, and it was leaking onto the drum mics, and it was in fact uncontrollable. And I couldn't really sort of take it anymore. So Jules Martin came into the control room. It was a Tuesday afternoon, from what I remember. And I said, George, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm leaving. So he said, well, let's go up and see the manager and discuss it. And then they sort of said, well, can you leave on Friday? And I said, no, I want to leave now.
Yeah, if you're going to quit, you should quit with style.
Well, sure. So they knew something was going on, because they were down in Studio 2 looking up at the control room window, and they were trying to beckon us, you know, waving their arms and flapping around to try and contact us when we weren't responding, because I was talking to George, and they realised something was going on.
This is the band you're talking about. This is the Beatles.
Yeah. 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 So we came back down. I went downstairs and I said, you know, I'm going to leave. I can't, you know, I've had enough. And then sort of John was the one that stepped in and said, oh, you know, it's nothing to do with what you're doing and blah, 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 you know, blah, blah, blah. And so he made a remark about something that Paul had done. And so they said, well, will you stay? And I said, no, I'm going to leave. I mean, I think I was on the point of a nervous breakdown, to be honest with you. It was that bad. It was that bad.
Strangely enough, the album is still considered, like all their albums, to be a tremendous piece of work.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you came back again, though, didn't you? You were drawn back.
Yeah, that's right. Because I'd left that at EMI, and I went to Apple for 4 years. And at that time, I think that was at the start of just before the start of Abbey Road. And then we went back to record the Abbey Road album. And at the same time, I was trying to build the studio down at Apple.
Mm. Take us through Abbey Road a little bit. The coming back after you've quit the band, we're in what looked like a crisis during the White Album, and then they returned to the studio, and things were a little bit better for you.
Oh yeah, they were, because when George, you know, because George Martin was asked or approached by them to do another album, and I at that time was not aware that this was going to be the last album. That thought never entered my head, although people do say, oh, you know, this is the start of the last album, but it would never have entered my head like that. But anyway, George was approached. And he said, "Well, you know, if I do this next album, we're going to do it like we used to make albums, and you know, have a bit more decor, and you know, and have a bit more fun doing it."
Mm.
And the other thing was, of course, on Abbey Road, it was the first time we had a transistorized mixing console and the luxury of more inputs and more compressors and limiters. But the thing that we couldn't get at the beginning of the sessions was the same drum sounds and same guitar sounds, because we were now in the realms of transistors. And they'd lost a lot of the punch.
Right, so the old valve technology that was being used beforehand.
Right. Mm. So for the first 3 days, we were sort of down in the dumps. Oh, you know, the guitars don't sound powerful enough, and the snare doesn't sound as punchy. But we had to resign to the fact that this is what we've got, and we made the best of it.
Mm.
And because of that, it gave Abbey Road a new texture. Because I'd had it been done through that Red 51 desk, the tube desk, Abbey Road would have sounded a lot more punchy and a lot different. I'm quite sure of that.
Mm. We're speaking with Jeff Emmerich tonight. He's a sound producer and was the engineer for the Beatles during some of their most famous recordings ever. Just discussing the final album that they were to release, Abbey Road, which of course had that famous front cover photograph of the four of them walking across the pedestrian crossing.
Right.
And there's some significance to the direction that they're walking, isn't there?
Yeah, well, my take on it, that the thing was, they were so sort of fed up with EMI Studios. And don't forget, they'd been incarcerated in there for a long time, and it wasn't exactly it was not coherent to work. It was, you know, bricks on the wall and bits of stuff hanging down on the walls and industrial lighting.
Mm. And they even had to bring in their own lights for a period, didn't they?
Well, yeah, just angle poised lamps, and they did put out a request to the electrician at Abbey Road for coloured illumination, and he came in with a mic stand with three fluorescent tubes stuck to it with gels on them. That was that.
Well, so here you have the most famous band in the world, unable to get the most basic lighting in their studio. It really does boggle. That said, you brought in some pretty interesting sounds. There was a some of the metal sounds on. It was an anvil that was used, was it not?
That was on Maxwell, wasn't it? Maxwell Silverhammer.
Yeah. Where did you get the idea for that?
Well, it wasn't my idea, but it was a real anvil, and Ringo tried to play it, and the hammer was so heavy he couldn't. And Mal Evans actually did it.
Right. Well, just too. The thing was too heavy to actually strike it in time.
Well, the hammer was, yeah, needed a lot of effort to lift the hammer up in time. And, you know, and so Mal Evans actually did the bongs on the anvil.
Yeah. Going off to work at Apple, what sort of experience was that for you, Jeff?
No, that was good. I mean, it gave me the experience of, you know, not talking about Magic Alex's studio. I mean, we had to gut the whole basement of Savile Row out. And we used the same designers that did Air Studios in Oxford Circus. And it took about 2 years to actually build it. And it was a really nice facility. And so it was about 2 years in the building, I believe, and 2 years it being a commercial studio. I did a few albums. I did a nice album with Tim Harding and a girl group called Fanny and some other stuff. But I was sort of running it, and Harrison recorded there. The Beatles themselves, as the Beatles, never recorded there. But it was a nice facility, actually, there. Well,
Jeff, what about the lifestyle of the time? We hear about the extracurricular activities of the Beatles, particularly during the years that you were engineering their albums. Was it a heady time for you?
In what way?
Well, the wildness of it, I guess. You know, I mean the.
Well, we were only privy to the wildness from what we ever read in the press. I mean, we weren't part of anything wild that was going on. I mean, you know, their life outside of the studio is completely different to ours, because we were still doing other sessions as well as their sessions, you know.
Right, yeah.
So we didn't have the freedom of clubbing at night and all the rest of it. That was not part of our curriculum, you know.
Yeah. That said, you maintained pretty good relationships with some of the band after they broke up.
Yeah, I still work with Paul, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, taking you back to that young 21-year-old Jeff Emmerich and the thought patterns, if you like, the approach to what you were doing in that studio, how much of that has formed your DNA for what you still do today?
Well, all of what I do today is based on that, and it always ends up being the, if I try another approach to something and I fall back on one of the approaches from then the approach from then always comes out on top, you know. And basically, you see, when I started and then during those days, we didn't rely on technology, obvious, and it was so much fun to create these things yourself, you know, with bits of string and sticky tape and God knows what else. So that was the fun part, but the musical part and the construction of the songs and everything else, you know, happened on the studio floor. And then you'd be down in the studio listening to them routining and blah blah blah. Then your ears would prick up at some sort of sound or combination of sounds that you sort of heard, you know, down in the studio, and then you'd base your sort of tonal recreation of what was happening in the studio based on what you'd heard down there, and not created it from up in the control room as you know the technical way is today. It was a completely different way of working.
Do you think that in some ways musicians, younger musicians today, might have lost some of that? I guess that critical element of being able to avoid the traps of all the technology and all the options, and just focus on the simplicity.
Yeah, so I mean that's such a shame, and it's obvious because the obvious thing Richard was involved with this. Richard Lash was involved with this when it was the 40 years anniversary of Pepper. We went to Mark Knopfler's studio in London and recreated the Sgt. Pepper album with 12 of today's top artists.
So you had Oasis and Razorlight, etc.
Yeah, and they were bands that were used to creating their records on Pro Tools. So one great piece of the footage is the Kaiser Chiefs who come in and almost throw the towel in. It's almost like Spinal Tap, this segment. and they almost throw the towel in because they do a few takes of the song, and then they come in and it's really bad, and they realise how bad it is, and they say, well, normally, you know, they go on Pro Tools and piece it together from the takes we've got. So anyway, they have a band meeting, and they ask for the cameras to be switched off. They have a band meeting, and then about 2 hours later, they came back, and then we did about 26 takes of the basic rhythm track and all the overdubs, and it sounded amazing. And, you know, we were using the same equipment that we actually made the original Sgt. Pepper album on, being, you know, four track and the Red 51 desk.
There's a few things to be learnt by the sounds of it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's an eye-opener. And normally, if I ever show this footage, you know, in any sort of seminars, you know, that's full of students, they normally just stand up and applaud because they know that's the way it should be, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jeff Emmerich tonight. He's an engineer and producer. He's been involved in music since he was 15, and also happened to be the engineer on a bunch of the Beatles records. Looking back, you've done a lot of other things besides the Beatles albums as well, Jeff. What else sticks out to you as something that you're particularly proud of or invigorated by?
Well, there was a band in America called America, so George Martin and I made all the America albums apart from the first one, and that was great fun doing that. Robin Trower, I guess, Elvis Costello, Imperial Bedroom. There's so many I can't really remember now.
Yeah.
Basically, if you think of a band, then we've done it, you know?
Yeah. Well, do you know what? The strange irony is that this evening show here in Sydney that we're on at the moment, the opening introduction title music to it was actually produced by George Martin, strangely enough.
Really?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So there you are. Look, Jeff, it's been an absolute delight to chat to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us. And we look forward to seeing you in Australia for the Integrate Trade Conference.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Good on you, Jeff. Thanks, mate.
See you, Robbie. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.